Oh, thank you, Ben. That's a great way to start the morning. A little energy in there. And we've been traveling the Jesus path. It's important, I think, while doing so, to constantly remind ourselves where the path leads, where it goes, where the destination is. And that's the destination, or dry bones dance. That's where the path of Jesus purports to take us. And as we travel through Lent, that's where we're going. The trouble is the path to get there. The path to get there is not easy. And we talked last week about how it will take us to death. You know, this past Tuesday, we did our first questions for you, our Tuesday evening Lent experiment. We gathered at Murray and Jane's. It's funny how a set of good questions will take you pretty deep, pretty quick. And it was one of those evenings, just magical conversations, wonderful conversations, but it should maybe come as no surprise that there ended up being tears and chats of hurt and pain and suffering. And you know, one of the interesting things I found this fall when I did labs at Nexus and took people through different sort of experiments with people in different stages of life is how often tears showed up. Pain. And then last week, I asked you a question. What is it in your life that feels like death? What's the most painful thing in your life? Where does it hurt most? And I sat preaching, not seeing anyone writing anything on cards, and I was worried. But then the end of the service came, and I had a box full of them. And we had the kids' gym time after, so I went and played in the gym with kids and got home around 4, and I carried my box here with me. I set it on the table, and I was scared to open it. And I didn't want the kids interrupting me, and so it just sort of sat there. And then I got them sort of distracted on screens. Every parent's a trick, and get them all distracted. And then I opened the box, and in front of me was our community's pain. Where does it feel like death? A family member came out, and I'm scared for them and me and how others will respond. I have difficulty with empathy, which makes relationships difficult for me. Crippling anxiety feels like it might kill me. The pain of failure in my parenting and my relationships. It hurts knowing that I'm never able to meet everyone's needs and I'm always letting someone down, including myself. For all my effort, it's never enough. The anger and frustration with myself for never or rarely following through, a cycle of self-sabotage that I can't seem to escape from. I don't trust myself. Dementia. Working for a corporation that's killing the world. My greatest pain and suffering comes from my fears and uncertainty about staying within the religious tradition I grew up in. Conflict. Declining, aging parents. Anxiety. Busyness. A family togetherness dream seems dead. Marriage, intimacy, sex, rejection, loneliness, sickness, and ongoing physical pain. Having trouble flipping through these. I can't relate to my grown kids. My relationship with my adult kids, surrendering my adult son, rejection, panic attacks. Surviving heart surgery and knee surgery, the health diagnosis of a spouse, my body is starting to fail me, being separated from my parents and my kids not knowing them, being alone, loneliness, feeling like a loser, financial loss due to divorce, the pain and suffering of my loved ones, my aging body. loneliness, 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 loneliness. Watching older relatives age, get sick and die, the loss of irreplaceable, soulful friendship. Finding joy and nuance in a world that seems increasingly angry and black and white, regret over so much time and money given to an evangelical belief system, aging parents, loneliness, lack of purpose. I'm not the parent I thought I'd be. I struggle to be present and enjoy my kids. I'm estranged from my oldest child. It's hard to hear about their life and not be part of it. Being seriously misunderstood. Others don't see the changes and advancements I've made. I can never earn as much as previous generations. I can't provide for or have as many kids or give them that particular joy. I can't protect them from poverty, relationship status. I'm interested in someone who isn't interested in me. Feeling stuck in my career. I've hit the ceiling. I'm not motivated or challenged. I need a change, but not sure what to do. Being forgotten. Fear that my kids will be lonely. My adult children only engage me when they want something or feel obligated. The painful process of losing a relationship. This is us. And the weight of those cards felt palpable to me last week. I felt like carrying this burden, the burden of a community's pain. And it's interesting because when you enter into a Sunday morning like this, and it's great to be together, but behind every single set of eyes here is pain and suffering. How do you carry that? I didn't know how to move on from here, and then this week, Kristen just sent me a text. Hey, listen to this song. I thought, that's it. It sums up, I think, what so many of us are feeling. And so, Kristen Band, help us carry the weight of those cards. Take us into this song. Thank you, Kristen and Band, a powerful song. And you know, leading up to Easter, what is there, four Sundays less, we've entered into the most demanding, the most taxing part of the Jesus path. The trail from here only gets more steep and precarious because here on this ledge, we're invited to leap beyond the solid ground of love. We're asked to travel towards, not away from death. And trusting, I think, the path at this point is perhaps the most difficult part of the journey. But I find solace in something. I find solace in remembering that this wasn't an easy part of the path for Jesus either. In fact, this is the one place that we see Jesus pause and even falter. Because fast forward a few weeks from his Mount Transfiguration event, and Jesus has now arrived in Jerusalem, and it's the eve of his trial, his crucifixion and death, and Jesus has just finished dinner with some of his closest followers. He's giving them some final instructions, some teachings, some exhortations, and after this emotional meal, this intense dinner, Jesus has less than 24 hours to live. And in this moment, one last time, Jesus is going to look for a place of respite. And for Jesus, that had always been the wilderness. Read through the Gospels. It's always the wilderness he wants to head to when he needs a refresher. And for Jesus, whenever the pressures of life were too much, he sought out solitary places, and he's about to turn the page on this final chapter, enter the greatest challenge of his life, and he once again searches for solitude, but he's in Jerusalem now, so the desert, the mountains, they aren't exactly available to them, so instead he heads to the only piece of wilderness that he can find. It's just east of Jerusalem in a valley. It's called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, or the Kidron Valley. And you go down out of Jerusalem, you travel through that valley, and right as you get to the slopes of Mount Olives, there is a quiet little garden grove. And it's as close to the wilderness as he can find. It's no mountain peak, but of course we're not on a peak here, we're in a valley. And it promises him just some quiet moments of prayer, preparing himself. And it's nighttime, and it's dark, and it's cold. And there's not much time left, and the scene we witness in the garden feels so penetratingly lonely. I'm struck by how many times that came up in the cards, loneliness. It's a penetratingly lonely scene for Jesus. Because he's there alone, and his closest followers, they keep dozing off, which is just accentuating his loneliness. And Jesus faces this moment of incredible doubt and anxiety. In Matthew's version, it's all too sparing, but it goes this way. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And he took Peter and two sons of Zebedee along with him. He began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." And going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to the disciples, found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch for me with 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." And he went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." And when he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them. He went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. I get so frustrated with the gospel writers here, because the details we're given are so tantalizingly brief. We get such just this little glimpse of this prayer of pain and suffering, and we're given the barest of details. In fact, all we really know is that over the course of about 3 hours while Jesus is praying, is he starts with, "Take this away from me. I don't want to travel this path." And 3 hours later, he's saying, "Not my will, but your will be done." In between, we're not given the details of that, except to say that this part of the path had Jesus sweating like blood. In between those two cries, I'm struck. What was the essence of Jesus' struggle in the garden here? And I've come to see this is ultimately about a struggle for Jesus between trust and doubt. And this is part of the Jesus path. It's an obstacle that everyone who travels it will have to go through at one time or another. The path is calling Jesus to one final act of love, to walk straight towards his death. One final challenge. Is Jesus willing to trust that the path that leads through death finds new life on the other side? And in the garden, Jesus wavers. Staring it down, it's on him. He's got less than 24 hours, and Jesus wonders, wait, can this path really be trusted? See, might there be some other way? Maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a path around this path. God, can I really trust you? Are you sure this is the best way? How can I know that there's life on the other side of death? Is this the end? Is there really a new beginning on the other side? Can I trust you? And I think, you know, in a place like Nexus, we talk about doubt a lot. I think almost every single doubt about faith ultimately comes down to that one question. God, can I really trust you? Are you a trustworthy God? Given what I know of you, given what I know of the world, are you a God who can actually be trusted? If I follow this path, if I enter into my own death and follow that, can I trust it'll actually end in new life? Or does it just end in pain, humiliation, and shame? And this was Jesus' moment of doubt. And I think it happens to the best of us, all of us. And so Jesus here, he's struggling, and I so badly wish we had pages of what he prayed. What did that look like? What did he say? But he struggles, languishing in doubt. And I wonder, did it cross his mind? Maybe I can run. There's still time. Maybe I could get out of here. Maybe I could run. I wonder if he thought about fighting. I got people. I could fight. I wonder if he thought about, I do powerful things. I can do a display of power. I wonder what went through his mind. But in the end, he chooses trust. But I think the Garden of Gethsemane is the most penetrating glimpse of self-doubt we're ever given in Jesus' life. And yet the final word in this time, in this event, is one of trust. Scared, faltering, doubting, wavering. He ends his time of prayer going, I'm going to trust. And then it begins. Betrayed. Abandoned. Falsely tried. Stripped, beaten, mocked, then hung on a cross, a crucifixion, one of the most humiliating ways humans have ever invented for killing people. And then on the cross, we're told, darkness descends over all the land. Seems as though even God has abandoned Jesus. And yet he trusts all the way till the end, and then he dies. It's a story of darkness, humiliation, shame, and suffering. It is, in many ways, our own stories. These. Because that's the indignity of life, isn't it? Is we all have to struggle with these. It seems to end in tragedy for Jesus. Oh, just another would-be Messiah. There's been a number of them. Another would-be revolutionary, calling the world to love, and it all just ends rather pathetically. If Jesus' message was about the power of love, well, it didn't seem to work. You know, it can be really easy in churches to be triumphal about our faith, and particularly about Easter. This happens to me every single, I'm going to try to drive a different route this Easter Sunday to Nexus, because it happens to me every single Easter. I'm driving here and I pass by a church and they always have the same sign. It always says, Jesus' resurrection changes everything. And every Easter Sunday morning I go, wow, oh shoot, this is not a good morning to be doubting. Inconvenient time. I got a sermon to preach. Jesus' resurrection changes everything. And you know, I trust that this is true. I really do, but not in the same ways that I used to. Because 2,000 years on from Jesus' death and resurrection, I fail to see how the world has changed much at all. Read the paper, news, when I read these, I find it hard to think the world has changed much at all. I find it hard to, how does the Jesus path change things? I don't really see it. The world's still a mess. Our lives are still a mess. Pain and suffering in almost every pair of eyes that I see and meet. So what changes? What is the big deal? Only this I've come to trust. Only this. Whatever death we're experiencing in life, it is not the end. It's not the end of your story or mine. What Jesus' resurrection gives us is simply a promise. Our stories do not end where we think they end. And when we feel our stories are caught up and trapped in grief and suffering and pain and humiliation, when we think our story is about done, the story of the world, the story of us, when we think it ends in despair and pain, suffering and death, our story doesn't end there. I love France. I want to go back. I want to take Kristen, but I backpacked through France. Loved it there. Smitten with the people. They can be pretentious, the French people, but I love the kissing on the cheek thing. I love it. I love it. Love it. And I was, friend Dan and I were backpacking. And a friend that we had met in a hostel, a new French person, was like, you must check out the catacombs. I think that's how French people talk, something like that. I'm like, okay, we'll do that. And so we got tickets to the Paris catacombs, and it was the weirdest thing. It was just like this random door on some side street in Paris. We entered, and I'm like, what sort of weird sideshow have we gotten ourselves into? And we gave them our tickets. We descend down the spiral staircase deep into the bowels of Paris, and then there they were. Catacombs. They were created as underground ossuaries because sprawling Paris, not enough room to bury all the dead, so they started burying them underground. And in the Paris catacombs are the bones of 6 million people. The experience of walking among them felt morbid but mystical. And you can't help but you're walking along and you're peering into the eye sockets of where eyes once belonged. And it feels almost voyeuristic being down there. But it's impossible when you're down there not to contemplate all these bones, how each of them housed flesh. How they used to walk. Each of these bones held at one time the story of a lifetime. And it's impossible not to contemplate your own mortality going through there. You look at them, 6 million lives, singing and dancing and having fun with friends and in pain and suffering. 6 million lives looking through them, looking at the bones and realizing, wow, their story ended up here. And my story's going to end up there. It was great. Last Sunday, Erica Toffelmeyer messaged me and said, you've got to get this app. And I love it. It's called We Croak. And I downloaded it. It's fantastic because what it does is on your phone is 5 times a day, it sends you a notification. Ding. You look at it and all it says is, remember, you're going to die. 5 times a day. And the idea behind the app, apparently, is that being reminded you're going to die 5 times a day makes you happier. And I got to say, I've only had it for a week, but I love it. I love it because here's what will happen. I'll be like angry on social media, but ding, remember you're going to die. Huh, thanks for the reminder. Maybe I should just stop doing things that are pointless and ridiculous. Let's move on. And it's been helpful, but you walk in a place like this, yeah, you remember you're going to die. And if you're familiar at all with the opening song, with the Hebrew Scriptures, it's impossible to walk through a place like this and not think about the absolutely magical story of the prophet Ezekiel's vision of dry bones becoming alive again. Ezekiel 37, it says this, the hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley, and it was full of bones, and he led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry, and he asked me, son of man, can these bones live? And I said, sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, son of man, and say it. This is what the sovereign Lord says, come breath from the four winds and breathe into the slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet like a vast army. I love it because dry, dead bones are about the best portrait we have of beyond hope. There's no life here. And the story, of course, is a metaphor, an image, a disclosure of the nature of God. And what we learn about God here is this. God gives new life where there had been death. God brings life back to the story of those who ended long ago. The driest of bones can have life breathed back into them. Nothing that is dead, nothing that has died or is dying is beyond the redemption of God. And at some point Each of us must wrestle with the most crucial of questions in life. Is the world ultimately a cold, hard, dead place, indifferent to us? Does death have the last word? Because if it does, then these cards are it. This is what we can expect to be the final word in life. And if that is the case, then despair is the only reasonable response. These stories, these cards, are the actual way of the world. And in that case, despair is the only, in my mind, honest and authentic response. And I wish sometimes when I talk to people who are leaving, jettisoning the faith, I never have the courage to, but I wish I could say to them, just make sure you're honest and brave enough to go the whole way. Go the whole way. Because if you jettison it, this really is just reality. That's very much how it could end. And in Gethsemane, Jesus wrestles with these exact same questions. Perhaps as he's sweating like blood, we're told, wrestling through doubt and despair. And maybe in that moment, he remembered this vision from Ezekiel. And in that vision, God pronounces with authority, never is death or darkness or pain or suffering or humiliation the last word, because this God breathes life back into dry bones. But I have bad news. That's the good news. But there's a bad news. And it's this: trusting in Jesus and in the Jesus path of resurrection, it won't save us from the cards of pain. It won't save us from humiliation and death in this life. It isn't meant to do that. And this is one of the most profound lessons of Jesus' cross. God is not in the business of rescuing people from pain, humiliation, and suffering. God is in the business of redeeming pain, shame, and despair. God is a God of resurrection far more than a God who rescues. Which seems confusing, no? And this plays out at Jesus' death scene, the cross, because this is the confusion of the people gathered there. It's one of the biggest confusions of people observing Jesus die on the cross. They're mocking him, but their mockery actually stands to reason. It's got a lot of weight behind it. This is what they're saying to Jesus on the cross. Hey, you. Yeah, you. The one who's going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Save yourself. Come down from the cross. If, there it's back, if you are the Son of God. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, I'm the Son of God. In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. That if is back. It stayed with him for his entire life. Jesus' identity throughout his whole life remains in question. In the early baptism blessing that he received, where God says, you're my child, I delight in you, I've empowered you, that remains in question. And here the cross, it finds its most poignant, powerful counter-argument. Because essentially, what they're saying is this, come on. You've been walking around for 3 years saying you're the Son of God. You got a child kinship with God. Are you kidding me? If that's true, how come God hasn't rescued you from your present pain, suffering, and humiliation? Come on, Jesus. Everyone knows that any parent worth their salt would save their child from humiliation. Any good parent. And so if God really is your father, then God would have rescued you. God has not. Therefore, you're a liar. You're a failure. This is why we spent so much time on identity here traveling the Jesus path, because it's always a constant temptation. And the temptation Jesus experienced in the desert wilderness, if you're the Son of God, if you're Son of the God, it's never left him. And I don't think it will ever leave us either. From the beginning to the end, There's suspicion over who this Jesus guy is, and it meets its final obstacle here. Everything you have trusted, Jesus, is a lie. He didn't really hear that voice. And the proof is in the pudding, because if you're a true child of God, then why are you hanging on a cross, suffering and humiliated? It takes a lot to embarrass me. I get embarrassed a lot, but it's so common that I find myself rarely rattled by situations. I'm like, another weird thing. Makes sense, just par for the course. It's hard to be humiliated, but there's been a handful of times where I've been humiliated. And it's usually something that happens very publicly. There's that too, Bronson, looking in the mirror, feeling a little humiliated, but no, that I can deal with. This, when I turned 27, I declared it my year of creativity because so many great artists die at 27, right? Cobain, Joplin, Hendrix, Morrison, Amy Winehouse, list goes on and on. It feels like that's the peak of creativity is 27, so it was my year of creativity. I got a fiddle. And I took it out once and said, I'm going to get lessons, and I never did that, and a whole bunch of failed projects, but I did fancy myself a painter. And so I started dabbling with paint and painting, and I didn't have any purpose. I just thought, if I just let my inner art shine, it will create these masterpieces. And so I created three pieces of art, and I was pretty proud of them. And it was right at this time that word reached my ear that our church, it was at the time, would be holding a silent auction. Oh. And these were always fun, right? Because there's always, the staff was encouraged to donate something for fun that people could bid on. The year before, I had this fancy white belt. It went for $400. And another one of the staff members, they made a pecan pie, sold for $650. You know, an excuse to give, have some fun. And the moment this came up, I'm like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to put on the auction block my best painting that I had entitled Campfire on Crown Land. Because it looked like a campfire. And so the evening unfolded, everybody's laughing, everybody's having fun. It's my time, silent auction. Everybody, the auctioneer's up. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Brad's masterpiece, Campfire on Crown Land. Remember, we're giving to charity. This is for the kids in Africa. So let's start the bidding. Do I hear 100? Who wants to give me 100? 100, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100. Silence. I'm like, it always starts out this way, right? You got to grease the wheels a little. Silence. All right, start too high. Who's got 80? Who's got 80? Who's got 80? Who's got 80? Who's got it? Who's got it? Give me 80. Somebody give me 80. All right, let's bring it down. 50, 50. Who's got 50? Who's got 50 for me? Who's got 50 for me? And it was at the $50 mark that the first came into my head. This isn't going as well. Now it's like, maybe things are a little tighter. The pecan pie this year only went for 300. So, okay, you know, we'll start. 50, 50, 50. No, 20. Who's got 20? Who's got 20? And now the silence is a different kind of silence. It's the silence of people going, don't move an inch. Don't move an inch. We don't want anyone to think we're maybe putting our hand up in the air. And even the auctioneer is getting flustered. This makes him look bad, right? 20, 10, 10, 10, 10. Why don't you tell me what you want for this? You tell me what you want. Remember, this is for charity. There's kids starving. They need money. Does anybody want this painting? Nothing. And everyone's staring at me. And I know I'm not Van Gogh, but we worked for hours on this. And it's the silence in the room is now screaming at me, your painting is so pathetic, nobody even wants it for free. And I'm thinking to myself, $2, you could use it for kindling, like nobody will say. And I'm sweating here, and I don't always get humiliated, but I was humiliated that at a charity event, no one would offer a dollar for my piece of junk painting. And I'm standing there sweating. And then, in the back of the crowd, $100. $100. The auctioneer didn't even want to try tempting fate with an auction a bit off. He simply said, "Sold to the lady in the back." And everyone craned to see who it was. And there was my mother. Yeah. She really could have piped in a whole lot sooner. But the tension of the moment had broken her. And she knew, looking at me, he's embarrassed. He's humiliated. She knew the room was embarrassed. And so to end my suffering, to end the room's suffering, she did what every parent would do. Rescues their child from humiliation. Because what parent wouldn't? What parent, seeing their kid humiliated, would not step in and say, enough, enough? And this is the tension of the crowd at the cross. You're at the heart of it, Jesus. There's no greater humiliation than this, and we don't hear anything from God. This is our tension as well, isn't it? God, I'm here, I'm suffering, I feel lonely, this feels like hell, this feels like death, where are you? Jesus had made that decision in the garden. The path gets very dark here, and it's not easy to travel, but I'm going to trust. I'm going to trust that in the end, everything will be made new. Trust in the resurrection is to trust that no matter your circumstance, your pain, your humiliation or suffering, no matter what it is you're experiencing right now, it's not the end. And it may seem like hell, and it may seem dark, it may seem like there's no way out. Jesus has walked this path before, and he trusted that through it, there's life, because this is not the end. I'm going to ask the band to come now. This was a painful exercise, I'm sure, to write. It was painful to read, but to walk the Jesus path is to travel to the land of resurrection, and it requires this radical leap of trust. To trust that the path of Jesus leads to resurrection is to trust that God has not given up on you because you matter. This world, your life, it all matters, and God will redeem and restore and renew. Pain, suffering, humiliation, frustration, disease, loneliness, broken relationships, they're never the end of the story on the Jesus path. And in the garden, Jesus wrestles with this here. He battles to trust that this is true. And in doing so, he finds resurrection. And everyone here this morning, it's clear, has a story of pain, suffering, humiliation to tell. And they feel tragic to me. But I want to tell you this morning, I want to look all of you deep into the eyes and tell you, whatever it is, what is it? Debt, divorce, depression, loneliness, abuse, addiction, cancer, violence, whatever it is, whatever part of your story feels like death, whatever part of your story feels humiliating and painful, wherever your story feels like suffering, this is not the end. And to walk the Jesus path is to constantly remind ourselves of this. So come with Jesus and join him in the garden where we sweat blood together and we wrestle through our doubts. Follow Jesus long enough and you'll find yourself there. But the path carries on, and no matter where you are in life, may you know your story is not done. The Apostle Paul tells us, in the end, we will shine like stars. And Julian of Norwich declares, in the end, all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. And why? Because this is not the end.